Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, September 12th. Dr. Josh Green is known as Hawaii's healthcare governor, and the nurses union is asking him to help with their labor talks with hotel management. We hear about a state budget primer in the effort to demystify the process of what gets funded with your money. And electric bikes are increasing on our roads, so how can the counties better regulate them? Our housing crisis didn't happen overnight, so what are the barriers to building new homes? We take a closer look. Plus, all things Italian, we learn about how you can immerse yourself in the culture, even though we are so far away from the boot. You'll be surprised to learn about the ties that bind us from the Mediterranean to the Pacific. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This week, the Hawaii Nurses Association called on Hawaii's healthcare governor, Governor Josh Green, to help in its labor dispute with Hawaii Pacific Health and Management at Kapiolani Medical Center for Women and Children. But the nurses union is also in talks on a new working contract with Queens Medical Center and is making patient safety and caseload an issue. Hotel workers are also in talks, and tourism is our main economic driver. We talked to the governor, who just returned from Japan, about these issues just within the last hour.
Look, I have a deep respect for the nurses and also for the people that run our hospitals. In general, governors should stay out of this kind of conflict and let them work out their family differences. They will be working together for the entire future, and it's better and more productive for them to come to an agreement. I would intervene only if I thought it was going to significantly harm our people. And I've talked to both the leadership of the Nursing Association and the executives at the hospitals, and they're pretty close. They're really just about 1 to 2 percentage points different on their, you know, in their finances and their agreement on salary. So I hope that they can reach an agreement. I will tell people that we are going to have backup nurses if there's a strike or lockout for a short period of time, and people will get their care.
Yes, I mean, because I'm sure families are a little concerned, you know, if folks are planning to have their babies over at Kapiolani, wondering, you know, what does the future hold and how is care going to be managed over there if there is a lockout?
I've been assured that it'll be seamless, and, you know, I don't want to ever see people not at work, whether it's a strike or a lockout, but there will be nurses there, there will be OBGYN doctors there, they will provide all the care that's necessary, and that is something that I will make sure of. But I'll tell you, this is a critical discipline. Nurses are very well paid in Hawaii in general, and I think we should always reward them, but I would love to see everyone come to an agreement sooner rather than later, because it's a little scary for people when they hear the word strike or lockout.
Well, you know, I understand it maybe not so much about salary, but more on, I think, what the nurses union is calling patient safety. You know, it's workload, you know, whether it's three patients, you know, per nurse in the ICU or what have you across the board. But there are just all these ramifications, because if we don't have enough nurses, how does that work? Then is there mandatory overtime, and do nurses get called in to cover shifts?
It cuts both ways. Believe me, I'm not taking sides. I will tell you, there was unbelievably little mandatory overtime. A lot of people take overtime because they want it. In fact, that's a huge part of people's salaries. It can add $30,000, $40,000 a year to someone's salary for overtime in the healthcare profession. So that's just part of what nurses and other healthcare professionals do. As to negotiating these kind of ratios, it's very difficult to do that. It's been discussed at the legislature for 20 years, and there's a reason it hasn't ever been legislated, because that kind of micromanagement is difficult when you don't know exactly what the acuity of patients are on the day-to-day basis or how many people are going to be sick that day. So that's really something that they should work out separately, in my opinion, because it is super difficult to come to agreement. Maybe they can, but that has not been something that's been doable through this kind of administrative process at the legislature. So I would hesitate on judging about that kind of thing. Let me be very clear. Nurses work incredibly hard. They should be paid well. everyone has been working incredibly hard since COVID. I see that as governor from the perspective I have, whether it's people that work at hotels or government workers or people who run their private businesses. Everyone's trying to catch up after COVID. And so this intense labor situation is absolutely not unique to any single group that we're hearing about in the news right now. Everyone is working harder than before because we're all making up for lost time. And I want that to be understood because, as governor, it is tough to see people struggle with their work. I'm trying to make sure they get paid enough to live here. And I'm sure that that will be the case with the nurses.
Whether it's Kapi'olani or Queens, I know that we have had just a crazy number of, you know, violent shootings and that kind of thing happen out on the west side. And our ER is then all of a sudden having to deal with an influx of patients like that when, you know, normally they wouldn't have to. But it just makes things a lot more complicated when you have those serious cases in the ICU.
Yes, it's true. The Waianae circumstance is heartbreaking to have seen the gun violence spike. And yes, it's very hard on the nurses and doctors and whoever's in the hospital at the time, or the police for that matter, because police and fire often are the first responders in getting people out of harm's way. What I'll tell you is we've really amped our responsibility in Waianae. I have to be honest, it's great work from the mayor and Representative Keela and Gates and Andrea Tupola at the council level. I mean, they've all really been engaged, and they asked for extra support, and we offered it. So there's like a bigger presence of state and local law enforcement to support Honolulu Police Department. Even DoCare officers are in there. So we're doing this for 3 months and building a full plan to prevent this violence. But a lot of it can only be prevented if community members find a peaceful space in their lives, because there's been some really terrifying madness that's gone on which created the violence, and that can't be solved with legislation or even extra patrol officers. People have to get rid of their guns the best they can. They've got to decompress their rage and stresses, so we'll help with those things. But these are the larger challenges when people are struggling to survive, and so this is a 10-year process to get people better jobs and better salaries so that their lives are better. I think that's what will ultimately decrease this violence.
And on that point, you know, that is one of the things that the hotel workers are concerned about in their bargaining, you know, with the major chains. And you have just come back from Japan, where you're trying to encourage our Japan visitors to come back again. What can you say on that front?
Again, I think there's got to be a fair negotiation with the hotel workers, and they need to make a living wage. You know, the hotel workers are basically making about $28 an hour on average right now. That's, I think, $56,000 to $58,000 a year. And it is difficult to survive on that salary in Hawaii if you don't have a significant other or other support. I'm sure they will get a raise, and it should be significant. Also, there are just fewer workers out there in each discipline, so there's been more work for people. And I know these are the points that are being, you know, debated and negotiated. I hope that we can get to a place where people can survive here just because they and their significant other are both working and just one job. That is within reach, and we've pushed really hard. You know, we've amped school teacher salaries a lot. We're going to see more of that for nurses and so on. These are working people. Firefighters deserve to be paid more, and police officers deserve to be paid more, frankly. But it's all in the context of what we can afford as a society, and that means I got to generate extra revenue, and I'll do it through a construction boom. And then you saw me, I was in Japan like for 10 days and met with everyone under the sun, big businesses and hoteliers and all sorts of travel people, and it does look good. It looks like as long as the yen can improve in strength a little bit, it does mean that the Japanese travelers are returning. And I'm teeing up some other ideas. For example, in advance of the 2028 Olympic Games, I'm going to push really hard to have mainland athletes and Japanese athletes come and compete here in Hawaii with the, I guess, the concurrent tourism that will come from that. People love this kind of stuff. Exhibition matches. We rally around things like the marathon. It's just an idea that's coming into focus, but a lot of additional possibilities exist, especially for the young travelers. So when I was there, I was working pretty much 24/7 for 10 days, and I was pleased with the results overall. We also had a big, big trade show, which our people did us proud. We had, I think, 45 vendors over there. mingling with all these other Japanese companies, which there are, I think, 2,000 total. And, man, people are crazy over Hawaiian things. So it was special. It is something that's going to, you know, require some constant attention. But I was really proud of our DBED team. That's the Department of Business and Economic Development, and our tourism folks. And I guess it turns out part of my job is to pump up Hawaii all over the world, which I'm happy to do, but we're trying to have better tourists, people that are willing to invest in Hawaii and our culture. And it's going to be a constant effort so that we don't get overrun by too many tourists, but we have enough revenue to pay some of these big bills. And it's a juggling act, but honored to do it.
Okay, and let's just hope then the labor disputes get resolved quickly. I know that the nurses are meeting today, and you know, the hoteliers as well, back at the table.
I think common sense will prevail on both sides, and there's no right or wrong party in this case. Honestly, there will be rhetoric on both sides. There will be frustration on both sides, but look, we'll maintain the care that people need, and it may be a little bit bumpy for a week or two, but I hope that at that point, you know, I don't have to intervene.
That was Governor Josh Green, who we talked to this morning about the labor disputes with hotel workers and the nurses union.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, recognizing September as Suicide Prevention Month. Learn more about risk factors, warning signs, and how to help at afsp.org.
Health organizations are trying to stay ahead of the curve as Mpox continues to spread in Africa. Vaccines have started to arrive, but so has misinformation. The internet is full of false rumors about this deadly disease. I'm Marco Werman. The fight against not just Mpox, but also misinformation, that's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
You often hear, follow the money, your taxpayer money. It may be all about the numbers, but many who deal with the state budget say it can be pretty dense. Well, there are a handful of state lawmakers who have teamed up with the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice to present a primer in a first step to simplifying the state budget as best they can. State Representative Della Albalati and Will White of the Hawaii Appleseed Center stopped by our studios to invite you to get in on the shortcut to understanding the budget.
I am helping to present this People's Budget Part 1 Forum with my colleagues, State Representative Janae Capella from the Big Island and State Representative Amy Peruso from the Wahiwa North Shore area. This is the first time we're doing this together, and we're very excited because we're also doing this in partnership with our community partner, stakeholder Hawaii Appleseed.
The idea is, it's kind of like, what, Budget 101?
This is a Budget 101. You know, Representatives Peruso, Capella, and I have been very vocal about how do we engage the public. And, you know, over the last couple of years, there's been lots of questions swirling around the budget. And so when we saw this opportunity to partner with Hawaii Appleseed when they put out their budget primer for the next year, we thought, let's do this. We had dabbled in doing some Budget 101 during the last legislative session, and we did host a small in-person gathering. But, you know, given all of our schedules and the timing of things, we really wanted to open it up some more and try to do it via Zoom, have it recorded. We have another partner. Olelo will be broadcasting it and then rebroadcasting it as well.
And so, Will, you were looking at a way to just demystify this budget process. You know, I mean, as a community group, you were trying to understand the numbers too.
That's correct. You know, I think the appropriate framing for a document like this is really looking at the budget as a statement of our values, right? It shows us what we as a community prioritize the most and shows where we're going to make investments that are going to hopefully be transformative for people's lives. So in that sense, you know, the budget really acts as a mirror that we can hold up to ourselves as a state and get a clearer picture of what we really value as a community and as a state collectively. But to do that, we need to follow the money, right? And really dig into the numbers, how the budget is structured, what the various means of financing are for the various programs, and basically make an effort to, as you said, demystify the budget, because it can be kind of overwhelming. There is a wealth of information online put out by both the Department of Budget and Finance as well as the legislature. But if you don't know where to look and if you don't know what you're looking for, it can be a little overwhelming. And it almost creates this sense of opacity through over-transparency, right? So what we wanted to do at Hawaii Appleseed is find the really pertinent information and dig through all those documents, because we know where to look, and package it into this budget primer so that lawmakers, advocates, and, you know, just budget curious members of the community can get a better understanding of how this document is structured and what it really does.
And Representative, I don't know, I mean, do you remember back your first term when you were going through the budget process, you know, with the House Finance Committee and then having to, you know, go toe-to-toe with the Senate Ways and Means?
I can remember that time, and I surely wished we had this kind of document to help understand the process. You know, members get training, we talk amongst ourselves, but it's also about how do you explain it in a way, and we didn't have this primer then. We had more technical explanations, and I think what's really great about this is that this opens up the process to the public. And it gives us an opportunity also to discuss it with our constituents, which is why we have this partnership.
We have the different caucuses, right? The Kapuna Caucus, the Kiki Caucus, Native Hawaiian Caucus, right? And so everybody's got their focus and their mission to advance, you know, what they think we as a community should be prioritizing, I guess. So this will be helpful in deciphering all that.
Yes, and this helps across all of those caucuses. Now, if you're asking me, do we have a good budget caucus? We do not have that. We do have very robust committees that review the budget every year, specifically the Finance Committee in the House and the Ways and Means Committee in the Senate.
And then this forum, you're going to feature former Governor David Ige, who was the head of the Money Committee in the Senate.
Yes, we are very excited about that partnership with him as well. You know, I think the budget primer talks about the nuts and bolts, but we're going to have an opportunity with Governor Ige to kind of do a deeper dive, right? And that's why also the legislators are there. We have a certain perspective on how the budget gets crafted. And so we want to be able to educate the community about kind of all the nuances. Sometimes it's fun and it's good to put stories to what we know are the nuts and bolts. And so that's some of the things that we hope to do when we have Governor Ige there with us, taking us through some of the maybe things that we didn't consider, the ins and outs of the budget, you know, revenues, implications of tax bills. You know, we're going to ask him some questions, and hopefully he will give us some insights about how we, both legislators and the public, can better engage in the process to have and develop a statement that really reflects our values.
So Will, as an outsider in this process, as the sausage is getting made, I mean, what was most puzzling to you? I mean, was it like the conference committees at the end where things get traded off and you don't know about it? Or I don't know, since you put this primer together, what were you struck by?
Yeah, you know, the budget itself actually gets passed generally pretty early on in the process. So that much is pretty clear. Where things start to get sticky is you have other appropriations that are being made outside of the regular budget, right? So like, for example, this year we had a large amount of emergency appropriations. These are appropriations to cover shortfalls or unexpected costs, for example, the Maui wildfire relief effort, and then just other one-time or short-term spending bills. So even though the budget gets passed relatively early in the session, we still have to go through all of those emergency appropriations and all of those one-time appropriations to really get a clearer picture of what state spending actually looks like. And unfortunately, that's a very tedious process, so it can be time-consuming. But I think the value of doing something like that is again, just getting a clearer picture of what the state really intends to spend.
And so is this designed to just get the average Joe on the street, or is it more folks, you know, let's say the folks that have a nonprofit or a particular group, you know, or a position that they're trying to advance? Who's it geared for?
This is geared for anyone who is what I call budget curious. If you have any inclination or desire to know more about this process, this is a great resource for you to start off with. I think primarily our audience for these types of documents tend to be, you know, of course, lawmakers, also other advocates that are working in the policy space. But we really are striving to make this as relatable and digestible as possible for someone that may not be as familiar with the political process. It's something that we're constantly working to get better at in all of our products that we put
out. And Representative, we were talking about the data book and having good data to base those policy decisions on. And a lot of the numbers in Hawaii's data book, I mean, there are really stories behind that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, during hearings, sometimes when someone testifies, that can move you and maybe change your vote on something.
Yes, the involvement of the public and the opportunity and the invitation for the public to engage in this process is something that is 100% a goal of myself, Representatives Peruso and Capella. When you ask who the audience is, we want people to be engaged. I love Will's term of this is for the budget curious. This is for everyone. Something that we've learned is that the public is very savvy and they understand and they come to the legislature January through May asking, pleading, requesting through the agencies that they work with, through the groups that they work with, through the advocacy and community groups that come in, and they are asking us to fund certain projects, to do certain things, to pass certain policies. And so I think that there's actually a hunger in the public to understand the process better, and that's what this is intended. And we want to engage everyone and invite everyone into this process, making it as transparent as possible.
What was a surprising thing for you? You've been in the legislature for some time, but maybe going through this process with this primer, I mean, anything jump out?
Well, I think in the context of the last 2 years, we've actually made some strides in making the process more transparent, in part because public advocates like Hawaii Appleseed has been encouraging the public to take a look more closely at these things. It's very easy for the public to think it's just my one bill that I need to focus on. But really, funding of projects is across the board. And when lawmakers are making decisions, we're constantly weighing priorities. So I think what I'd say that's surprising in the last 2 years is that because of the push from people like Hawaii Appleseed, we've become more transparent. There are some good things that we're doing, but there needs to be more done around transparency and engagement and education of the public about our budget process.
And Will, what about for you when you were going through this to try and simplify sometimes bloated process or cumbersome process?
You know, I think I was most struck by the particularly large number of emergency appropriations that were allocated this year. I think a lot of it's understandable. Of course, the Maui wildfire relief, but these are things that don't always happen all the time. So to have such a high volume of those in this year really kind of stuck out to me.
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, random things like the deer population issues, right? I mean, just things that you wouldn't normally think, well, this is an emergency, but sometimes, yeah, things happen. Then you got to do
things
something
happen.
Drastic.
Yeah, and I think it's important for the state to be able to be nimble enough to respond to those emergencies. And, you know, we also have to keep in mind that the budget is really a spending plan, right? It's not actually telling you how much money is being spent, because there are a number of reasons why a particular department or a program just can't get that money out the door. But really what the budget stands for is it sets out what you expect and sets a cap on spending, right? So it's really just an outline of what is possible.
I don't know. Any final thoughts that you want to underscore, Representative?
What I'd like to underscore is that this isn't just a one-off. This is a part one. We are working on a part two, and we'd also like to engage the public in some in-person meetings because this is dense stuff. And I guess that's one of the things that I would say has struck me about the budget quote-unquote process over my 18 years. It is a marathon, and we create our budget from year to year. It's an evolving picture. It's an evolving tool. It's an evolving plan all the time. And I think one of the things that a lot of advocates that I'm speaking to, they understand that they have to do this constantly. You're constantly looking at the budget. And part of, like, some people come to the legislature and think, I just need to pass one bill. But with the budget, it's actually, I have to look at a bill over the marathon of a session, over the marathon of a biennium, over a marathon of a governor's term, to really see if my priorities are being met. And so I think that's something that's a takeaway for me. So just as that process is a long process, our process to educate the public is going to be more than just this forum. And I'm going to want to invite all of your viewers to engage. We'll put out information about when the forums happen. We're going to have a second forum with other experts from Appleseed in mid-October. And I know that we're going to also have some in-person forums in October as well.
Okay, but this is kind of like a small bites of the apple in the process, right?
That's right. That's right. And I also want to mention that my predecessor, Beth Giesting, who's our director emeritus of the Hawaii Budget and Policy Center, will be presenting alongside Governor Ige at the forum on Sunday. And Beth is an absolute master of the budget. For folks that are going to be attending on Sunday, there is no one better to lead you through this process. She has so much institutional knowledge about the budget, and I think is going to be a really great way for folks to really dig a little bit deeper into the process and hopefully come away with it with some good learning.
Okay, so just keep an open mind and just don't be intimidated by numbers.
Do not be intimidated at all.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for carving time out for us.
Thank you.
And that was Representative Della Albalati and Hawaii Appleseed Center's Will White, who invite you to join them this Sunday for a budget primer webinar. It'll be televised on Olelo Community Media, and they hope that this will be the first of several bites at the budget apple. We'll have the details on the conversation page of our website later today. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today we're focused on our beloved local staple, the Spam Musubi. Before it was served in its rectangular form, the rice snack used to be made or sold in the form of a triangle. It was only when the innovation of shaping molds came into the picture that a musubi really became a rectangle. So for today's backyard quiz, do you know the name of the person who some say started the rectangle Spam Musubi? Well, call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Crashes with electric bikes are on the rise. On Oahu this week, a 14-year-old boy collided with a pickup truck and was taken to the hospital with serious injuries. HBR reporter Ashley Mizuo joins us to talk about what's being done to make it safer for all of us on the road. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, so e-bikes are getting more and more popular. There are over 5,000 e-bikes that are registered in Honolulu. And, you know, with this increase in popularity, there comes that question of, you know, how do we regulate this newish thing? And so that's what the Honolulu City Council is trying to tackle. I spoke with Eduardo Hernandez, Director of Advocacy at the Hawaii Bicycling League. That's been around for 50 years.
They fill a really important transportation niche for a lot of individuals and families because they're an affordable method of transportation and with a little bit of assist, help people to get a little bit further without any carbon emissions. So it's more sustainable, more affordable, and it's going to be a growing method of cycle transportation.
But, you know, in Hawaii, there aren't clear standards of the different types of e-bikes that can range from motors that only assist a person while they're pedaling to fully motorized rides that can reach up to 28 miles per hour. Bill Clem is CEO of the e-bike manufacturer eBliss Global. His company just started selling e-bikes on Oahu. Clem says that unlike Europe, the U.S. actually also has no universal standard for e-bikes.
When automobiles started, there was no roads, right? And there was no regulations, there was no stoplights. So all of those things followed automotive demand by consumers. the same thing is happening with e-bikes. So you're now getting e-bikes that are starting to become very prevalent. And so the local municipalities have to think about and come up with guidance on, you know, how this should all work and what safety is.
Yeah, we just saw, you know, what happened with those electric scooters, right? That was kind of crazy, and the city didn't know how to deal with that.
Right, when Lime came and kind of dropped all those scooters all over the place without having any infrastructure in place to how it would work and where they're supposed to ride. And so, yeah, I think that this is what the Honolulu City Council is trying to get ahead of with e-bikes. Honolulu City Council member Tyler DeSantos Tam introduced a measure that would create different classifications of e-bikes and include some safety requirements. So the bill breaks down e-bikes into three different classes. Class one has a motor that only kicks in when the rider is actively pedaling, and then that one can reach 20 miles per hour. Class two has a motor that can be used without pedaling, and that one can also reach 20 miles per hour. And then there's class three, which has a motor that assists with pedaling and then also can reach up to 28 miles per hour. Here's DeSantos Tim.
28 miles an hour is very fast, especially for a teenager who can't even get a learner's permit to drive a car, can all of a sudden be out on an e-bike going 28 miles an hour down the middle of the street. That's unsafe, and that's contributing to many of the accidents that we see out on our roads.
I have seen so many kids popping wheelies in front of me with those electrical bikes, and it's scary.
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of part of it too, is that, you know, this idea that children can just get the bike without having there be regulations, and parents not really knowing, you know, what where the line is there. And so I think that that's what this is also trying to combat, is trying to figure out, you know, there are different types of these types of bikes. Some of them are a lot easier to use and others are not. And so DeSantos Tam's bill would also require helmets to be worn while riding class three e-bikes. So those are the motors that go up to 28 miles per hour. And they would not allow those under 15 years old to operate one. He says beyond just making clear standards for HPD to enforce, if they have to, it also empowers parents and guardians when they talk to their kids about it.
I think with this regulation, it gives these conversations that family members have a little bit more teeth. It's the law that you have to wear a helmet. It's a law that you can't be riding down the middle of King Street on your e-bike. And hopefully that also helps create some expectations and norms around, especially our young people riding these devices.
And so DeSantos Tam expects that another measure will be introduced to address other micromobility devices like one wheels, electric scooters, but he wanted to focus on e-bikes first. The city says that while Beaky bike share bicycles, which they control now, are none of those are electric, they're continuing to kind of consider that option as part of the program's future.
Yeah, but you can see how that could be tricky, you know? So do you need helmets attached there and they get
to
rent the helmets?
Right, and also it's expensive. So I think that that's also cost prohibitive. They are looking into grants, though, for different things that they could do with Beaky bike share.
Yeah, but it's interesting just to see, where this is going to go. And then, you know, our statewide traffic code, how do we deal with these newfangled things that appear on the road? It seems like every other month we've got something new.
Right, yeah. I think that it's been difficult for the city to kind of, you know, you're always playing catch up with the different types of devices that come out. So something new comes out, and then you have to come up with regulations or safety concerns for those. So, yeah.
Right, statewide with each county. But thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Ashley Mizuo talking about e-bikes. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, committed to the people of Hawaii, working to help keep workplaces safe and protect employees' rights. HIOSH.org.
In the darkness, let there be light. HPR is the spotlight that shines upon community voices, fresh ideas, and music selections that dare to venture deep. May you find HPR illuminating, inspiring, and informative. Best of all, you help power this light source that's HPR, an independent nonprofit. Start with a $10 a month donation. Donate today at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Progress is being made for families to rebuild in the burn zone following last year's Maui wildfires. But what about all the other housing inventory that needs to get built just to meet our residents' needs? Joining us to talk about that is HPR reporter Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, you know, we've often heard, oh, it's our land use process, the permitting process that adds to the, you know, the delays in getting stuff built. But what'd you find?
Well, that's for sure part of it. But, you know, as we know, there's this Maui housing crisis. There's just not enough stock for residents. And people have said, well, why don't we just build more houses, right? But it's not that simple. So I looked into some of what those reasons are. Here is JC Nekonomou. He's a lawyer on Maui who's worked in housing policy for nearly a decade, and he was also just named CEO of Maui United Way. Here's what he had to say about it.
You have a housing crisis that got significantly worse very suddenly, displaced thousands of residents, thousands of working class residents who have limited resources and limited options as to what they can do after they're displaced from their housing. And you can't build new housing anyplace else because regulations, because of access to water, because of issues as far as what you're going to do with your wastewater. That's a really big storm. That's a really big problem that Maui County is facing.
Yeah, I mean, we had a housing crisis before the disaster. It's like a super disaster that we're dealing with, a super crisis.
Exactly. So, you know, the housing crisis didn't happen because of the fire. It certainly exacerbated it, but there's just, you know, this massive shortage happening. So it was also a topic of inquiry, really, at a recent congressional hearing for federal wildfire response. The leaders of that hearing really questioned local officials on, you know, what the barriers to building more housing are and why that hasn't been done leading up to the fire even. Mayor Richard Bisson talked about particularly the infrastructure barriers and challenges, water and wastewater. And here's what Mayor Bisson told me during an interview.
We're trying to explore water now because we just have enough water as it is on West Maui to accommodate the current amount of housing units that are there. Pulelehua, that unit, had identified two wells that they had on their property, and that's how they were going to accommodate their water for their new subdivision. Well, the water hasn't been approved by the Department of Health. So they would need our water, which is the water we're already using for the people that currently make up the west side of Maui. So unless we find more water, that part of the island will be severely restricted from building more units. And the people from there know this. You know, the county owns 25% of the water. 75% is privately owned. But even that privately owned water is allocated and allotted for uses. Water is the source. Water is the key. And we have water issues throughout the island. On the east side of Maui, which is why we now have an East Maui Water Authority, it's an issue on our neighbor islands. It's an issue here. So when we come to discussing building units, we have to be able to provide infrastructure, sewage, and water. Now, other parts of the island, they're more likely like Waikapu. They have, I think we're talking about 1,500 units coming online. They have met the criteria, but we got to build that new wastewater treatment plant in our central Maui area because we're nearing capacity at our Kahului site.
Yeah, it's complicated.
It is. So the Pulelehua development in West Maui that he mentioned is currently on hold because the county of Maui has said, you know, there's just not enough water in their system to support it. And, you know, they looked at wells and that water turned brackish. And so, you know, that's just another holdup in that particular development. But it really does boil down to a lot of water issues. And the Waikapu wastewater treatment plant that he mentioned for central Maui, you know, the Kahului current facility is nearing capacity. There's just not enough infrastructure there to support any new builds. And so there's currently no timeline for moving forward with that new treatment plant. It is, you know, being proposed. It's coming down the lines, but, you know, it's a lot of these things are just a matter of time. And, you know, water is such a, you know, finite resource. You know, finding new sources isn't really a simple thing. the UH Economic Research Organization's Hawaii Housing Factbook also highlighted permitting delays as a barrier to building in Hawaii, particularly on Maui, that has the second longest wait time, with median permit processing times averaging at 400 days, so over a year to approve new permits. And of course, all of those water issues factor into that, but it's such a complicated issue and definitely not as simple as just building our way out of this housing crisis.
Yeah, it's very sobering. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel about the latest on building more housing on Maui. And now it's time for the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier today, we brought up the rectangular version of the Spam Musubi. Some trace its origins back to the Joni Hana restaurant on Kauai, dating back to 1982, after one of the employees created a rectangular mold to shape it in. It soon became popular among Garden Isle residents and eventually the whole state. So who's responsible for the innovation? Well, some point to Kauai resident Barbara Funamura, who is the answer to today's backyard quiz. And our winner today, Alejandra from Kaneohe, who shares that her grandkids listen to HPR and they love musubi. Me too. But thanks so much for calling in, Alexandra. And that's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from TS Restaurants and its Legacy of Aloha Foundation, supporting the Maui community and assisting those affected by the wildfires. More about how to help by searching tsrestaurants.com Legacy of Aloha.
This Sunday on The Real Deal, it's the soulful sound of Cannonball Adderley, one of the most popular jazz musicians of the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. Join me, Seth Marco, this Sunday, 8 to 10 on HPR 1, Cannonball Adderley.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, recognizing September as Suicide Prevention Month. Learn more about risk factors, warning signs, and how to help at afsp.org.
You know, this summer, a stunning historic ship sailed into Honolulu Harbor, and traveling with Italy's Amerigo Vespucci was a photographic exhibit about the Mediterranean Sea and its sea life. The Friends of Italy Society here in Hawaii hosted a closing event this past weekend. It featured beautiful arias about the sea, as well as a talk about the marine environment on the other side of the world. Elizabeth Case is the president of the club.
So this was our Siamo Mare, We Are Sea, is what that means. It was our closing reception for the photographic exhibit that was brought to us in July as part of the visit by the Italian sailing ship, the naval training ship, Amerigo Vespucci. So part of the message of that ship, which is the oldest ship in the Italian Navy,
The most beautiful ship in the world.
Yes, known as the most beautiful ship in the world, which it really is. Their message, while they're training these naval cadets, is to talk about climate change and the importance of the ocean. So this exhibit was brought to us by Italian photographers. And, you know, of Italy, of the ocean in Italy. And what we learned on Saturday at our closing reception, we not only listened to beautiful, beautiful opera singing and accompanied by a pianist of songs about the ocean, but we also got to hear from a marine scientist, Simone, at the University of Hawaii, and a local Italian photographer more about the photos and about the importance of this particular seaweed's role in the environment and how it's not waste when you see it on the beach. It's actually feeding the birds that are coming by. And so, you know, you're just learning a lot about how they're caring for the environment in Italy and how we care for the environment here. He was talking about some of the work he's doing in Kaneohe Bay.
And I was struck by just the celebration of the things that connect us, even though Italy is, you know, on the other side of the globe. It's just all those wonderful things that bring us closer together.
Yes, and music is a wonderful way to learn about other cultures. You know, music, arts, food, of course, and language. So one of the songs that, and they just did bits and pieces of songs that maybe you've heard before, but we got to read along in the Italian and the English. So one of the songs they did was Santa Lucia. So I don't know if you know that song, Santa Lucia.
Yes.
And it says, on the sea glitters the silver star, gentle the waves, favorable the winds. Santa Lucia, come into my agile little boat, Santa Lucia. So it's just such a beautiful song. And I never really focused on the meaning of the sea in all of these songs that I've heard many, many times, you know, growing up, going to the opera.
Yeah, and so talk about your connection and how that love for opera was nurtured.
You know, my parents, you know, my father learned about opera just, you know, listening in the dorm room in high school, you know. And we had a Hawaii opera theater, you know, here. And so they just attended the opera as much as possible. We lived in Hilo, and they would come over and visit, and they would plan their trips to Honolulu around the opera. And then they raised us going to the opera. We didn't have the subtitles back then, so my mother would bring the libretto and little flashlights for us to read the words while they were singing. We would read along, and, you know, gave us little candies to keep us going. But, you know, and I did the same thing with my girls. I started to bring them at, you know, 10 years old. My poor daughter, the first opera I brought her to was Madame Butterfly. And I didn't tell her. I didn't want to spoil. And she was in tears at the end. And she said, "What? How could you bring me to this opera?" But anyway, yeah, my father used to say, "Oh, Betsy," you know, he would just like walk out of the opera and he's like, "Italians write the most beautiful opera." So I just developed an interest in, especially in Italian opera.
And then you went away to college over in Europe, right? And that,
yes,
you were able to explore Italy.
That was, you know, I wanted to study art history. And this school, Franklin University in Switzerland, it's in the Italian-speaking canton of Switzerland. There are four national languages in Switzerland, so it's literally 15 minutes from the border of Italy, just north of Milan. They just happened to be recruiting, and the dollar was like 2-1 at the time, so it was a wonderful price to go to school in Europe. Then I lived, I went there for 2 years. I studied, my degree was an AA in European Studies. And I lived with a family. You know, I had started out in a dorm, but I felt like I wasn't learning anything because I was with American kids and we weren't being immersed. So I asked to live with a family, and they didn't speak English. And they just talked to me all day, all night. And they had little kids, and these little kids would read the Richard Scarry books to me, you know, in Italian. And little by little, I just learned and immersed myself in the culture.
And so, you know, now that you're president of this society, I mean, you have a number of events besides the one, you know, that you held this weekend, but you've got a number of things coming up this month even.
Yes, our signature events are our language classes. So they're going to be starting soon in September. And we have a beginner, intermediate, and advanced level. And they're really small group conversational classes, wonderful teachers who are, you know, professors in real life. And it's fun because they do themes like the last one was learning Italian through recipes or learning Italian through movies. So you go home, you watch the movie in Italian, and then you discuss it. So it's a fun way to learn. And then, of course, it's a professional textbook, you know, Italian textbook. And then we have some cooking classes coming up. We have one, they're with professional chefs. Maria Costa is going to teach us how to make arancini, which are the little rice balls that I just devour every time I see them. It's kind of like a street food, a festival food in Italy. They're fried rice balls. And then we're doing cannoli, which are, you know, sort of the symbol of Sicilia. I went to Sicily for 2 weeks and I had a cannoli every single day. But, you know, there are these pastries, cream-filled pastries, and they can be pistachio or, you know, stracciatella flavor. Actually, we did a wonderful event not long ago, a limoncello making class with Yolanda, one of our Italian teachers, is from Naples. And that's where, you know, the lemons are famous in Naples. And what she shared, which I will share with you, is the secret is that the uglier the lemon, the better, because it's all about the skin, the there thick skin of the lemon. So what do you do with all these big, ugly lemons? You make limoncello.
There you go. Well, so it just sounds like then, yeah, you celebrate the Italian culture, you know, with these various events. And so if people are interested, they can find out more about the Italian Society.
Friendsofitaly.org.
And I understand that it got its start around the time, is it Mayor Fossey, is that right? I
mean, 1990, a group of citizens, they were arts supporting citizens. They wanted to support the symphony. And so we kind of started that way with a fundraiser and got the Italian consulate involved. And we have an honorary consulate here, Michele, Dr. Michele Carbone, who's a cancer researcher. And then our Italian consulate is actually based in San Francisco. So Sergio Strozzi is our Italian consulate in San Francisco, overseeing Hawaii. But the Italian consulate that at the time supported us. And, you know, the idea of the club is to help people learn about the culture of Italy. But I think, you know, we're really trying to expand it so that people understand the innovation that comes out of Italy. So, you know, I don't know if you follow the America's Cup, but I've been watching this Italian ship, which is crazy, like a Ferrari on the water. Yeah. And then, of course, the Amerigo Vespucci came at the same time as the newest Italian naval ship, which was just amazing. And they were crossing in the ocean, the oldest and the newest. So that was fun, too.
Yeah, I had the wonderful opportunity to visit both of them. So it was nice bookends.
Very exciting.
But yeah, so you don't have to be Italian to join the Italian Society, correct?
No, this is anybody who wants to learn about the Italian culture. You know, I went on to get a master in international management, cross-cultural communications, because, you know, it's about understanding another culture so that you can communicate better. And we all want to be global citizens. So these are people that not necessarily are Italian. I'm not Italian. I like to say I'm an Italian at heart. But many of them are maybe second, third generation Italians who never learned the Italian language. And some of them are Italian, so we love our Italians, so we like to support them here, especially our students. And then some of them are just people like me who just want to be immersed in the Italian culture.
All right. Well, Elizabeth Case, thank you so much for
Grazie.
Being here. That was Liz Case, president of the Friends of Italy Society of Hawaii. We will have links to find out more on the conversation page of our website later today. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, it's Hawaiian History Month, and we have a Hanaho show about Hawaii royals. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Google, Spotify, or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation. Lucia,